Okay, Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 14. At this point, we're about right in the middle of Solomon's 10 or 11 chapter prayer to Yahweh for wisdom. And after discussing wisdom and the beauty of wisdom, he began speaking about idolatry and the beginnings of idolatry and how idolatry takes hold and takes root in a society. And as we will see here in Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 14, he begins to discuss how cults start, how idol cults start. And in one way, in one aspect, and that will lead us into the idolatry of Egypt once again in subsequent chapters and why Egypt was judged and for what reasons and methods the children of Israel were saved from that judgment and from captivity in Egypt. That's sort of the overarching theme anyway. So here we're going to see Solomon describe the beginning of cults, idol cults. In one manner anyway, because I'm sure there were several different ways. The great heroes of the Greek past became gods or demigods. Okay, and that's all I have to say. That's where we're at.
Again, one preparing himself to sail and being about to pass through the savage waves calls upon wood more rotten than the boat carrying him. For indeed a desire for profit contrived and a skilled craftswoman prepared that. But piloted by your foreknowledge, O Father, because you have given even a way in the sea and a sure path in the waves, showing that you are able to save from all things, even when a man may tread without skill. But you desire not that the works of your wisdom be idle. Therefore, even in the smallest piece of wood, men entrust their lives, and passing through the waves, they are brought safely in a boat. For also of old, upon the perishing of proud giants, the hope of the society, taking refuge upon a boat, had left for the age a seed of the race, piloted by your hand. For blessed is the wood by whereby righteousness comes.
And we should probably stop.
Yep.
Right okay. There, Noble.
Sure.
I'm getting feedback from somebody. I'm sorry, Noble. It's from you. I'm sorry. I was talking over you.
Okay.
I just wanted to say a couple of things. And first, that this this man preparing himself to sail calls upon wood more rotten than the boat carrying him, that's really picking up. The subject doesn't break from the end of chapter 13, where it speaks about a man who makes good vessels out of wood, and then he takes the worst pieces of wood that are all knotted and gnarled, and he makes idols out of them. He carves idols out of them. So that's why we read here, for indeed a desire for profit contrived. And then it says, and a skilled craftswoman prepared that. And in the King James Version of the Apocrypha, it says a workman built it by his skill, which is fine. But the truth is that for one reason or another, the word there for craftswoman is a feminine form of the Greek word. And that's why it says craftswoman there. Because they must have had woman artisans back in those days, just like we have them today. Women aren't left out of the skill set, right? So there were probably women too who did those things. And in this case, Solomon decided to use a woman as the model for this creation of this idol for some reason, even though in chapter 13, it was a man. So that's okay. That's not really a problem. I'm sure men and women were involved in the arts back then, just as they are today. But we see that it was done out of a motive for profit beyond the workman's usual vocation of making useful objects out of wood, like bowls or furniture or whatever. So he took the useless wood and probably made more money off it than he would of a bowl. So that's compared in contrast to the useful wood, which was the actual boat itself, which is much more valuable than the small piece of wood that men would worship and that men would offer prayers to, as we saw earlier in the Wisdom of Solomon in chapters 12 and 13, that men were offering prayers to these useless idols that can't themselves do anything. And the same thing is true today. Phenomenon today in the modern world where people pray to relics or they pray to statues or bits and pieces of wood or rosary beads or something silly like that. It still goes on. Men still consider the things created, the menial things, more valuable than God himself. And they worship the idols. That's all I wanted to say here. It is to bridge this with chapter 13 so that we see that it's one flowing narrative and not a new idea here.
Well, we've got to do the rest of this paragraph, Bill, where it says, "But you desire not that the works of your wisdom be idle." He's having mercy on an idolater there, isn't he? Because he's allowing an idolater to live. He's delivering him through the sea, even though he's an idolator. Isn't that what that means there? "But you desire not that the works of your wisdom be idle."
Yes, absolutely. So men make it to the other side safely in spite of the fact that they entrusted their lives on the smallest piece of basically useless wood.
And in spite of the fact that they might thank it when they get to the shore, ignorantly.
I was sort of saving that conversation for the next paragraph, but we'll expand on it then.
Yeah, because but then we'll...
The next we'll paragraph miss... expands on the concept.
Okay, then. Okay, but can we not... We'll miss this bit here, Bill. It says, "For also of old, upon the perishing of proud giants, the hope of the society taking refuge upon a boat had left for the age a seed of the race piloted by your hand." So we see that the reason the flood was designed to destroy the giants, the fallen angels, and the hope of the society, not the hope of the world, was for this one race. So the world is this one race, and Yahweh's preserving this race, the seed of the race, through Noah. And we know in Genesis 6 that Noah was perfect in his descent and abided in his race. So that's what I would cross-reference it to.
Absolutely. The message is absolutely, without a doubt, a racial message that the seed of that race, that Adamic race, was preserved on the boat, on a small piece of wood in the flood of Noah. The perishing of giants, I'm sure many giants did perish that were mixed among the children of Adam in Genesis chapter 6 when the flood struck. But the entire race of giants or Nephilim certainly did not perish because many of them were outside of that area and appear in many later scriptures. And Solomon must have known that, but here I believe he's taking a poetic license, more or less, to draw the contrast.
Yeah, Solomon would have known about Og of Bashan.
And all of the other giants, I'm sure. But that's getting back. Somebody before we started here tonight, somebody asked about the Targums. And the Targum Jonathan, or it's the Targum Onkelos, maybe. I think it's the Targum Onkelos, goes so far as to claim that Og of Bashan survived the flood by hiding on the roof of the ark. But that's Og of Bashan isn't the only one of the Nephilim that survived the flood. Maybe the writer of the Targum, maybe that's the only one he hoped we'd notice.
But many
Nephilim survived the flood.
Maybe he believed in a worldwide flood, Bill, so he had to come up with a way to explain why there were still giants, and he's like talking about a giant on the top of the roof.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The Targum Jonathan also references a giant holding on to the ark, a different one, started with an O. I forget his name.
Okay. Well, that shows how old the worldwide flood belief is. But they didn't understand how large the world was at that time.
They did understand that Noah wasn't going to let a nigger on his boat, though.
Right.
They understood that Noah was perfect in his race, so he's not going to let anything corrupt all that. They understood that Noah was preserving the creation of God, I guess. They understood that, and they understood that Noah was part of that. And that the giants weren't. So they understood that much. That's what I can glean from that. They understood the giants weren't part of it, but Noah was.
Right. Absolutely. So that alone should cause people to stop and think when they see these giants mentioned in Numbers chapter 13, in verse 33 several times, and Goliath, and all the way through the book of 2 Chronicles, I believe, or 1 Chronicles. Through past the time of David.
And Yahweh, he saved the seed here through Noah. But more ultimately, he saved the seed, the entire seed, himself as Christ. And Bill, you mentioned this not too long ago, how verse 7 is also a prophecy. For blessed is the wood whereby righteousness comes, and that's the cross.
Absolutely. And that can be considered another messianic illusion.
Yeah, so it's like, it's even inferring that Christ is preserving the race, right, Noble? It's like Christ is racist. Right.
He certainly is. Yeah.
It's inferring that.
Yeah, it is. It is, yeah. And whereby righteousness comes. Well, we're righteous because of the seed which is in us. And that seed is preserved through Christ.
I love the wisdom of Solomon.
Yeah.
It's an amazingly deep book.
Yeah. Should I continue?
Sure.
Verse 8. But that which is made by hand is accursed, and he who made it. Indeed, he, because he fashioned it, and it, being corruptible, is called a god. For equally hateful to God are both the impious and his impiety. For that which is brought about shall be punished with he who accomplished it. Therefore, even upon the idols of the nations shall there be a visitation, because within the creation of God they have resulted in an abomination and in scandals in the lives of men, and for a trap for the feet of fools. For the beginning of fornication is the invention of idols, and the discovery of them is the corruption of life. For it was neither from the beginning, nor shall it be forever. Indeed, by the conceit of men, it entered into the society, and for this reason, the abrupt end of them is planned. And I think I'll abruptly end it here too, because there's a lot to say here.
Yeah.
I mean, I just want to say, Solomon, where did he say it? For equally hateful to God are both the impious and his impiety. Well, that goes against the whole church phrase of, you know, hate the sin, love the sinner. God hates the sin as much as he hates the sinner. And that's what Solomon is saying here.
Yeah, you know, there's probably a lot of reasons why the Judeo-Christian churches don't like the wisdom of Solomon. A lot of reasons.
Oh, yeah.
It does pull apart many of their false doctrines, especially the real meaning of trees and branches as being races of people. And other things like that. The contrasting of different races, as we saw here just now in the first paragraph. The beginning of fornication is the invention of idols, and there goes the Roman Catholic Church, right? I mean, he's talking about these things that you carve and you worship, and you come to worship them and say prayers to them, even though they can't talk and walk and do anything of their own accord. And
You cut out, Bill.
And that Solomon is basically demeaning here.
And what's the corruption of life, Bill? You know, what could that be? You know, so that we have these idols that suddenly these idols accept all people. You know, Yahweh doesn't accept all people, but the idols of the Catholic Church accept all people. So now all people are welcome. And then we have the corruption of life. What could that be? Now, what's that, Bill?
Yeah.
Mentions yeah, fornication there. You know, what's fornication? What could that? What's going on here? You know, dumb it down for me, bro.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Joe, it's basically a Hebrew parallelism, isn't it?
Seems to be. I'd say once these Catholics welcome all the non-whites into their church because they've got an idol set up, a false Christ, then life is corrupted because they're intermarrying with these niggers and these kikes and these scum, mongrel trash. And so that corrupts life because the spirit of Yahweh cannot dwell in a broken cistern. It cannot dwell in the body of a bastard. So that's the corruption of life. And it wasn't like that from the beginning. Verse 13, when it was neither from the beginning, nor shall it be forever. That's because Yahweh didn't create bastards and he's not going to let them enter the kingdom, his eternal kingdom. So it's not going to be forever. And indeed, by the conceit of man, that's how it entered into society, by the sin of man. This fornication and corruption entered into society. Death entered into society. Just like it says in Genesis where Eve sinned and now death enters the garden.
Even in Genesis chapter 35, Jacob tells his sons to put away the strange gods that are among you. They were taking off into idolatry already. The very sons of Jacob.
Oh, I didn't remember that. Wow.
So, I mean, it took seven generations from Adam before the children of Israel really became involved in fornicating with the Nephilim from about the time of Enoch. Well, it took one generation from Jacob, and they're at it again already with the strange gods.
It really shows you what happens if the father and mother aren't unified in the faith. Because, you know, Rachel, Leah, they were still pagans.
Yeah, and the bondmaids were certainly, the handmaids were certainly pagans.
Yeah, so like these children, they're being raised with these conflicting ideas.
Without a doubt. So it doesn't take long to go off into fornication and idolatry. Or idolatry and then fornication. Once you accept, and this is a theme throughout the Old Testament, throughout the book of Numbers, the book of Deuteronomy, Judges, Joshua, once you accept alien people, you accept their gods. And you can't accept the people without accepting their gods. So there's your fornication, the pursuit of that idolatry. And you accept those people, and you're basically accepting their gods.
I've heard you also say, Bill, that once you accept an nigger into your congregation as a Christian, how can you deny him your daughter? Because now he's a Christian.
Right, you can't. There's no moral basis. Because we're all one in Christ. So if you accept that niggers can be Christians, you can't deny your daughters. And that's the quandary that the white world is in today.
So it all begins with idolatry. The beginning of fornication is the invention of idols. So he's exactly right.
Should I finish off the chapter?
Well, you know, yes, 1 minute, Noble, I'm sorry. That this whole paragraph is explaining what he said in the previous paragraph. The whole paragraph is basically a parallelism that clarifies a lot of the things in the earlier paragraph. So basically, the salvation of Noah in that small boat is the saving him from the fornication that followed the idolatry of the children of Adam in Noah's day.
And where it said, I was just thinking in regards to what you say, Bill, where it says, for it was neither from the beginning. Well, at the beginning, we just have the one race that Noah's part of, and he's abiding in that race, as we're told in Genesis 6. So it wasn't like that from the beginning. And then you have that creation by Yahweh being preserved on that ark. So that sort of harkens back to Noah too, that for it was neither from the beginning part.
I agree. And even if you, you know, because of the challenges that we have today, we focus greatly on the racial corruption message of Genesis chapter 3. But once you were assured and certain of that interpretation, that that interpretation is the one that is most correct, it is the orthodox interpretation, the only true interpretation, then you could also see that Eve worshiping a tree is tantamount to the idolatry which Solomon speaks of here. It's symbolic of it. Even though we know that tree was really an allegory for a race of people that Yahweh did not create, a tree of knowledge of good and evil, Eve's worshiping a tree is symbiotic with the worshiping of chunks of wood here by men.
All right. That's a good point. That's a great point, Bill.
Yeah, that's really good. Wow.
And you've got the two trees, but the there's only one tree left in Revelation, the tree of life. So it's not gonna, nor shall it be forever.
Right. Right. It wasn't in the beginning and it won't be forever, because Yahweh God is his will over his creation is going to prevail. And until it prevails, like Solomon had written in Ecclesiastes, man is subjected by God to this transiency, to this vanity which we suffer now. But it's not going to be forever.
Yeah, that's why Paul, he writes in Romans that Yahweh subjected the creation to transientness in expectation. And Paul says that in expectation.
Right. Yeah, I cross-referenced that passage with Ecclesiastes. I think it's chapter 1 and it's verses 12 or 13 when I did my commentary, because in more ways than one, not only with wisdom, but with Ecclesiastes, Solomon was a great source of inspiration for Paul of Tarsus and the other apostles.
I stepped away for a sec. Did you guys speak of verse 12? How they inserted a spiritual fornication in?
Yeah, but I wouldn't call that spiritual fornication. I think right. That's what, and we discussed it, and that's what leads to actual fornication, is the worship of idols, that once you accept a people, you accept their gods. You can't, Yahweh's the God of Adam at this time of which Solomon writes in the flood of Noah. He's not the God of the Nephilim. The Nephilim are his enemies, that they already fell from his grace, the fallen angels, and they're his enemies. And that's not revealed until the revelation, but it's very clear in Genesis chapter 15 and forward, wherever the Nephilim are mentioned, they're the enemies, and the children of Israel were to destroy them.
I think what David means, though, because your translation has for the beginning of fornication, which is correct, but the KJV has for the beginning of spiritual fornication.
Right.
They added the word spiritual, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they just added it.
Well, the reason is, too, is because what they're doing is they're trying to make a construct out of it, because that's what they're doing. The Catholic Church is doing that.
Yeah, right. They do. And that's exactly what it leads to. The fornication. You put Mexicans that worship Mary. Mexicans, I've seen Mexican men worshiping who you would think on the surface were Catholic. All they care about is that virgin and that baby, and everything that the virgin and the baby represents. That's all they care about, and that's what they worship. They don't care about the adult Christ and his teachings. They don't care one whit about that. So you take these Mexicans and think that they're Catholic, and you put them in church with Irish and Polish and German families, and you're going to have all the Irish and Polish and German daughters with Mexicans. And you can't deny them, or you're not a good Catholic. And I've seen that in huge numbers in New Jersey when I was a kid growing up. Puerto Ricans and Cubans moving into Irish neighborhoods and going to churches and coming home with Irish girls.
The corruption of life.
And the only thing that they really have in common is Mary.
Yeah.
The Catholics worship Mary. And that's the only thing. If you taught the adult Christ that everything that he said, the Mexican would want no part of it. Or the nigger.
Couldn't live by it. Yeah, well, they can't live by it even if they wanted.
Right.
Even if they tried their damn hardest, they couldn't live by it.
Yeah, so I mean, that verse is saying that basically that leads to corruption of life in the cage, but the creation is what you put in your
word spiritual.
Yeah, it doesn't exist.
It does not exist in the Greek. There's no word for spiritual in the Greek, not even close. There's not even a word that you could twist into spiritual in the Greek in that passage.
Yeah, because the actual translation is like their hands caught in the cookie jar here.
Their actual translation is itself idolatry, which is ironic.
There's only 10 Greek words in it. In verse 13, I'm sorry. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, there's 10 words, 10 Greek words in verse 12 too. 10 Greek words. For the beginning, the fornication is the invention of idols, and the discovery of them is the corruption of life. It's like 15 English words because they're necessary. The little prepositions and the verb is in two places, but there's only 10 Greek words, and there's no word for that could even remotely mean spiritual. That they just have to twist the scriptures to match their doctrines. If the scripture refutes their doctrines, they obviously don't have any moral problem and any compunction against twisting the scriptures.
Yep. Like 2 Thessalonians 3:2, faith is in the nominative case. And they're like, oh, it's the object.
This is the, they're switching the subject and the object of the sentence again.
They do it all the time.
That's like their go-to method of lying, I suppose.
You know, like, I'm teaching myself Greek, and like one of the first things you learn are nominative and genitive, because that's really easy, that's really simple. And not too long ago, I went to 2 Thessalonians 3:2, and I'm like, even I can translate this. It was really simple. Like, faith is in the nominative case. Yet they put it at the end of the clause, like it's the object.
Yeah, they make it the object of the verb. They make it the object of the verb have, and the verb have doesn't even appear in the Greek in that
yeah. clause. So I'm a Greek newbie, and I'm like, this is a simple clause.
Ex-Murph, your mic's open.
Oh, sorry, bud.
So they really have no excuse. The Greek isn't complicated. They're just deliberately dishonest.
Yes. But that's what I've been saying for years, since I was a newbie.
Yeah, I know. And you know, I praise Yahweh because now I can see it myself. I'm like, yeah, wow. It's kindergarten Greek sometimes.
But they even do it where they don't have to twist the translations, right? That they'll teach that many nations became Abraham's seed. Without twisting the translations, they teach that. That they teach that the Jews aren't his people because they don't believe him. Which and they didn't twist the translation. They translated John chapter 10, verse 26 properly. But they still teach the opposite of what it says.
Yeah.
So even where they don't twist the translation, they still manage to stand there with bold faces and insist that it means the opposite.
Yeah, because those scales are over their eyes. And that arrogance is in their heart, too.
Yeah, it's absolutely arrogant, and they're absolutely lying.
You know, Christian identity exegesis is really easy because all you have to do is read it and believe it.
Right.
But then you become a Nazi, so.
Right.
I mean, National Socialism, that's what I stand by. And yes, absolutely, Pastor Fink. And my friend is also listening, and just so you're aware, he's trying to learn some more about Christian identity. Cool. I'm still trying to get him sorted out, but thank you.
No sweat.
I'm happy to continue the chapter.
Sure.
Verse 15. For a father distressed with untimely mourning, having made an image of a son suddenly taken away, now honors the dead man as a god and delivers to his subjects mysteries and rites. Then being strengthened over time, an impious custom is kept as a law, and carvings were worshipped by the commandments of tyrants. He whom within sight men were not able to honor on account of dwelling at a far distance, modeling an apparition from a distance, they made a visible likeness of the king whom they honored, in order that, as being present, they may flatter he who is absent through the attention. Then, in the diligence of religion, even those ignorant of the craftsmen were urged to devotion. For indeed he, perhaps being willing to please the ruler, expressed in his craft a likeness more beautiful, and the multitude attacked on account of the grace of the work. The man, who was little honored before, is now accounted an object of worship. And this became as a trap in life, that in the circumstances in which tyranny enslaves men, that the incommunicable name is bestowed upon stones and wood. And then this is not sufficient to be deceived concerning the knowledge of God. But even living in the great war of ignorance, they designate such great evils as peace. For leading either children-killing sacrifices or secret mysteries or frenzied festivals of strange ordinances, they keep neither lives nor marriages clean any longer. But one slays another in ambush or causes pain committing adultery. For all hold promiscuously blood and murder, theft and guile, corruption, disbelief, disorder, false oath, confusion of good things, forgetfulness of favor, defilement of lives, corruption of race, disorderliness of marriages, adultery and licentiousness, for the worship of idols, not to be named as the beginning and the cause and the end of all evil. For either rejoicing they are mad, or they prophesy lies, or live unjustly, or quickly swear false oaths. For trusting in lifeless idols, swearing maliciously, they do not expect to be done wrong. But for both causes, punishments shall pursue them. Because they have thought wickedly concerning God, given attention to idols, and unjustly swear with guile, despising sanctity. For it is not the power of those who are swearing, but the penalty of sinners always prosecutes the transgression of the unrighteous. That is awesome. And Solomon literally says here, corruption of race. He attributes that very explicitly.
Wonder what the KJV has, corruption of generation or something.
Yeah, likely. And he says disorderliness of marriage in the next clause there, in the next statement. And that's basically the same thing. Living their lives, nor marriage is not clean any longer.
But well, disorderliness of marriages and adultery and licentiousness, right?
Yeah, like it's all the same thing. Yeah.
Forgetfulness of favor, forgetful of the fact that your nation had the favor of God.
And then nice what? Sorry, Bill.
And that the others in contrast don't. You're forgetting the favor that Yahweh has for Israel when you marry into another race. And I tried to make this point in my recent Genesis commentary with Esau. When you marry into another race, you're committing your heritage to that other race. You're giving it away to another race.
Also, isn't it called white privilege today? You know, we should be ashamed of the favor from God we have and try right. And throw it away to the other races because we're so ashamed.
Yeah, they want to rip it out of our fingers, right? Well, this isn't every way that idolatry starts, but evidently it's one significant way. And there are not necessarily in a filial relationship, filial meaning a relationship of a father and a son. But in other ways, we see examples in scripture of people declaring an idol to be a god. And probably the first example that's explicit is in the golden calf, where the people commanded that Aaron make this golden calf so that they could worship it as a god. And even more explicitly and more enduring was the declaration of Jeroboam I, who set up the calves and created a priesthood in Dan, and I think in Bethel, that the children of Israel would worship the golden calves. So only like three generations later, in the time of Elijah and Ahab, it may have been four generations, I don't really know, I haven't counted anyway. In the time of Elijah and Ahab, you only had 8,000 men, I think it was, left in Israel who had not bent a knee to bow.
Yeah.
So that shows the power that a tyrant has when he declares a state religion that's contrary to the established religion. And that's what Jeroboam I did. And in a few generations, it was evidently pretty effective.
James, in his own epistle, he writes, "Brethren, Elijah, he was a man of like nature with us." And that verse really hits home because we know what it feels like to be surrounded in that same sense as he was. Just reminded me of that. That's all.
The first century apostles had that too. They also had that same.
Yeah. That's why James says, "Brethren, Elijah was a man of like nature with us."
Verse 29, it says, for trusting a lifeless idol, swearing maliciously, they do not expect to be done wrong. But, you know, we know the punishment will pursue them anyway. So this is sins of ignorance. People today don't realize they're being punished by God because of their idolatry and because they're letting all these non-whites in, but they are being punished. You know, the presence of the non-whites is a punishment. And our people, God has a right to punish our people whether they realize it or not, because he created them.
It is sins of ignorance, Joe, you're correct, but it's also sins of arrogance, because so many of these people claim to be Christians and they've never opened up their Bible to see the words of Christ.
Yep.
They have no excuse. It's right there. You claim to be a Christian. Have you read the Bible? Just like you claim to be a National Socialist. Have you read Mein Kampf? Most people who claim to be National Socialists have never read Mein Kampf. Most of the online Nazis and the pagans have never read Mein Kampf, but they'll claim to know Hitler.
Absolutely.
Most of today's Christians, that they've never read the scriptures, but they claim to be Christians and know Christ.
Yeah. I mean, I was talking to Joe a couple weeks ago, and he was giving me encouragement to go to a church and to have fellowship and try to share the truth with people. And I'm not going to go on a digression on that, but we did. And we spoke to a few people, and I was just like, they've never read the Bible, have they?
But you know what they have done, Noble?
What have they done?
They have a personal relationship with Jesus. He talks to them, and so they don't need to read the Bible.
Well, I mean, I had to deal with the idolatry there, because I went to a Baptist church, and I didn't know Baptists did this, but they practice communion. So they were passing around this bowl of like rice crackers, and I was like, oh no, I know what this is. And they passed it around to everyone in the church. And there was quite a few people there. And my wife and I were there. We did not accept the rice cracker. And I'm sure we got a few faces. And we watched as this bowl went around the whole room. It took a long time. And then finally they finished. And everyone didn't eat the rice cracker. They were all holding it in their hand. And then like their pastor guy stood up. And he read the verse from 1 Corinthians, which they take out of context. And then all at once, in this huge room with like really good acoustics, all at once, there's like this one loud crashing crunch, like crunch all at once, because they all took a crunch out of the rice cracker at the same time. And I really felt like I was surrounded by cultists, and like my hair stood up on my arms and everything. It was really creepy. And I'm like, this is idolatry, because they think they're righteous because they all took a crunch of the rice cracker at the same time, like a team. And I'm sure if they thought if they did it earlier, it wouldn't have counted. Or if they did it later, it wouldn't count. But they all did it at the same time, this resounding crunch. And that's idolatry. They've turned the rice cracker and the grape juice or whatever it was, they turned that into idolatry. And you just have to, I had to feel that in the room. It made me feel uncomfortable. Sorry, I don't want to go into digression, but it does fall under the category of idolatry.
They think that their little rituals will save them instead of like, it's like workspace salvation.
Yeah, and it was weird. It was really creepy. It was just like boom, crunch all at once. It's like a ritual they're doing.
That is pretty creepy.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard me, but I started to say that I watched this online service in 2013 at this Baptist church in Abingdon, Virginia. And the first thing the pastor said was a joke cracking on poor West Virginians.
Right, when I remarked on that,
I remarked on that in their chat, and immediately the moderator claimed that I was persecuting them.
Yeah.
That they're just so arrogant, and they're so convinced in their cult that their way is the right way, and that they're all saved. So once you're saved, you can't be unsaved, right? And they have all these crazy ass doctrines that are basically work salvation, like Joe said. They're full of themselves. It's arrogance. So it's the sins that they sin today in ignorance. They do. They don't realize that they're being punished by God. They don't realize that we are under the curses of Deuteronomy chapter 28 right now. And they go about in a self-righteous impudence because they don't even want to know what the Bible says. They have their church doctrines and are saved, and that's all they care about.
Yeah.
Why would they think they're being punished if they're like already saved? They would never imagine they're being punished.
Yeah, because they think it's, like you said, Joe, it's a personal relationship thing. It's not the chastisement of a people. It's a personal, you're right. Yeah.
It's funny how their personal relationship with Jesus doesn't ever reveal things like that they shouldn't sin.
Yeah. Well, every time they suffer something in their life, they just ask for prayers and they don't really do any introspection.
They never repent.
They only see the Ten Commandments as sin. And there's nothing in the Ten Commandments. They don't realize that the Ten Commandments are only the basic beginning of the commandments of Christ. The basic beginning of the law, which Yahweh gave to the children of Israel from Exodus chapter 18 or chapter 19 forward. They only see those 10 commandments as sin and everything else is a go. So it's okay to be a fag because it's not in the 10 commandments.
And what about in the 10 commandments how it has do not covet thy neighbor's wife and that and do not commit adultery? They don't realize that that's two different commandments.
Well, of course not.
So one's obviously referring to, you know, what we see as idolatry, and one's referring to fornication.
Yes.
Right, and they think it's the same thing.
I don't know if I said adulter. I kept saying, I couldn't say adultery before. I kept mispronouncing it. So,
we know you
sorry
meant
about
adultery,
that.
Joe. We weren't going to pick on you about it.
Sometimes I just can't get the words out right.
Yeah, me too.
Well, I had one more comment on verse 22 where it says to be deceived concerning the knowledge of God, but even living in the great war of ignorance. Is that great war of ignorance? We're still living in that today. Hey, Bill.
Yes, we're going to be living in that great war of ignorance until it's all said and done.
Oh, yeah. Until our people repent, a remnant of them.
They designate such great evils as peace. So, like, getting along with all these non-whites, that's peace. We're not in a war. We're living in peace. We're living in peace with the Jews, and we can all get along.
We are the world. We. Yeah, the rod is firmly against the cheek of Israel, and Israel doesn't know it.
Yeah. They think we're all friends. They're all coming here to be our friend. We have so many friends, you know. They're all just coming into our countries to be our friends.
They eat pork together. They marry together. It's all great. They worship Mary together.
And no one has to go to hell.
Great war of ignorance is such a poetic way to put it.
Even the King James translated it like that.
Yeah. Well, Solomon's a poet. He shows it time and time again. And of course, the Spirit is working through him.
Children no killing. Translate that, but living in the great war of ignorance is the only real way to translate that, period. You'd have to really innovate to come up with a different translation.
Yeah, I guess you could do like mighty war of ignorance, but that sounds dumb. I think we see this thing about like somebody dies and they craft a statue to honor him. We still see that today. There's a lot of statues of great men, and they sort of turn into figures of idolatry.
They can. especially in the ancient world where they worship, they actually worshiped heroes. A lot of those gods were really heroes of one age or another in great antiquity. And many of them weren't really heroes, but tyrants. They may have been heroes to one race and wicked tyrants to another race. It's all the perspective of the victors.
Yeah, so men like Achilles and Hercules, they were likely real men.
They very likely do represent real men, yes.
Now we get statues of George Floyd.
Yeah, right. Three-story murals of some fucking crackhead nigger.
You guys want to do the next chapter?
Wait. So in this chapter, it mentions that the craftsman is making such beautiful idols that the people are compelled to worship him, right? Well, now our idols are ugly niggers. What do you say about that? How can people be compelled to worship George Floyd when he's an ugly nigger and we've got all these ugly statues around?
I mean, they even made a turd statue like a couple months ago in Chicago or something, dedicated to a Martin Luther King or something. So that's a gross statue. That's even worse. And they're likely, yeah, how do you worship that? I'm sure some weird woman would try. Some weird feminist or some soy boy or something would do it. They're like, I'll show you how.
Well, people should wake up.
The degeneration of art, as Jews get more influence and power in society, art typically degenerates. Look at the Renaissance artists. Look at like Rubens or Michelangelo or somebody like that, and the wonderful works that they carved with their hands or painted. And look at like Picasso. It looks like children's drawings, but his paintings are going for millions of dollars at auction, and they're priceless, right? And they're masterpieces because the Jews write the newspapers and the art columns.
Yeah.
Picasso painting and imagine it to be worth $1 million, then you could worship George Floyd because he's probably less macabre than anything Picasso ever painted.
I think a lot of that Jew art is sort of like a money laundering scheme.
Hitler had an artist band, Franz Marc, and you look at Franz Marc's work and it's crap. And then you look at Hitler's work, some of his landscapes, and you're just like blown away, like, wow, Hitler was actually a very good artist. And he was selling his pieces and supported himself for many years selling his art, right? And now Franz Marc sells for millions of dollars, and Hitler, you don't see any of his artwork. And Franz Marc was crap.
You know, I quoted the Austrian painter in my last podcast, right? in Genesis chapter 34, I got a quote from Hitler in there.
Nice.
Like statues, like the Statue of David. Like, it's way larger than you think it is. And like, there's videos where it shows like all these details of veins and the hands and thighs. And there's so much thought that went into it. Like, it's a real work of art. But that sort of gives me a question. Is that idolatry? Like, that to have a statue like that? Like, the Statue of David, that's a good example. Like, would that be considered idolatry? David was a real man. We built a statue of him. Or is it the spirit of the law? Is it how we treat the idol?
Yeah, you know, I understand that the law forbids images, period. And I got carvings in my own house. We got a wood carving that was made by a guy, an old timer in South Carolina on a wall. But we got some pieces of art, not art like you would buy in a place, in a studio somewhere. I wouldn't have any of that crap. Well, I'm talking about folk art, stuff made by hand by people down here. Yeah, you know, we don't worship it. It hangs on a wall. It looks cool. And sometimes we might laugh at it, but we don't worship it. It's the spirit of the law, I think, is more important than the letter of the law.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
We have pictures of ourselves, that memories of ourselves on our walls.
Right. That's a good point. Like, where's the line?
Didn't the temple have carvings of pomegranates?
Yeah. They were instructed to carve pomegranates on the pillars and walls.
Yeah, if you dug some of that shit up today, some archaeologists that didn't know any better, never saw a Bible, would think that it was a pomegranate cult. These people worship pomegranates.
Yeah, I guess it's not really idolatry. Like, say some like grandmother has garden gnomes, you know, around her house, like, and she thinks they're cute and wholesome, like, spirit of the law.
Yeah, we had a garment. We had a garden gnome of a gnome sitting on a toilet, and another one of a gnome taking a leak.
I've always loved garden gnomes. Seriously, I've always loved them. I always make sure I have one.
They're kind of funny and they're goofy, yeah, but yeah. We don't worship them. We don't pray to them. We don't lay incense at their feet or anything crazy like that. Pour oblations to the garden gnome. The only oblation I pour on a garden gnome is when I pee in the wrong place because it's too dark at night.
Some guy was telling.
Just got peed on.
Some guy.
I've got a question for y'all.
Gerald got a little nigger statue outside.
That's right. That's Leroy. And I love him to death. I go hug him all the time. What about all of the Confederate statues that are honoring people like Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson? Would you consider that as part of idolatry?
Yes, it's a very fine line, Gerald. If you're worshiping the individuals, if you're worshiping men and praying to men, or that you should hope that they're praying for you. They're the ones that they didn't have to live through the civil rights bullshit, even though they lived through the Civil War. If you're worshiping men and praying for men and you're worshiping them in a way that you're taking time away from the things that you should be doing to spend on them, yeah, that could be a form of idolatry. And there's a fine line between, and I gave this a lot of thought even when I was in the League of the South, there's a fine line between wishing to preserve your culture and thinking that you're preserving idols, right? There's nothing wrong with preserving your culture and records of your culture and your people. As long as you're not idolizing.
The way I looked at it was, I'm not worshiping these individuals. I'm paying homage I've lost my mind. I'm honoring them for what they stood for and what they fought for. I'm not honoring them as individual men.
Yeah, the Bible says, remember the things of old.
Yeah, you know, they may not have carved likenesses in them, but quite often in scripture we see that the children of Israel set up stones as a memorial. To remember an event, to remember some significant event.
Well, is that idolatry?
No, not if you're doing it for that reason, to preserve your culture and memories of your history and the struggles and battles that you've suffered.
Well, that's what we do down here.
Well, they want us to just worship George Floyd. I'm kidding. No, I'm not. Martin Luther King. They want us to worship them so that we embrace their ideals. That is a form of idolatry.
Exactly.
If we embrace Martin Luther King Jr.'s ideals, then we're basically worshiping Martin Luther King. If we commemorate our own ancestors and our own fellow countrymen for their achievements or for some memorial of some great struggle, we're not worshiping or embracing their ideals. We're staying in the ideals of our people. we should be only, the only ideals we should be worshiping are those of Christ. We can do our best to uphold those while loving our own people, but we can't uphold those and chase niggers. No. Or worship the communist ideals of Martin Luther King.
Robert E. Lee and all is more like a history marker.
Right.
We have to keep the law in spirit. The spirit of the law. We only worship God. And there's nothing wrong with commemorating and memorializing the struggles of our ancestors.
Chapter 15.
I think we should probably hold it here.
Okay.